We parked under a porte-cochere in the back, along with another pickup. There was a small Nissan parked off to the side. There were a couple of motorcycles, too, and Trey gave them a glance of professional interest. "Whose place?" I was a little hesitant about asking yet another question, but after all, I did want to know where I was.
"Amanda's,"
he said. He waited for me to precede him, and I went up the three steps leading up to the back door and rang the bell.
"Who's there?"
asked a muffled voice.
"Sookie and Dawson," I said.
The door opened cautiously, the entrance blocked by Amanda so we couldn't see past her. I don't know much about handguns, but she had a big revolver in her hand pointed steadily at my chest. This was the second time in 2 days I'd had a gun pointed at me. Suddenly, I felt very cold and a little dizzy.
"Okay,"
Amanda said after looking us over sharply. Alcide was standing behind the door, a shotgun at the ready. He'd stepped out into view as we came in, and when his own senses had checked us out, he stood down. He put the shotgun on the kitchen counter and sat at the kitchen table. "I'm sorry about Marie Starr, Alcide," I said, forcing the words through stiff lips. Having guns aimed at you is just plain terrifying, especially at close range.
"I haven't gotten it yet,"
he said, his voice flat and even. I decided he was saying that the impact of her death hadn't hit him.
"We were thinking about moving in together. It would have saved her life."
There wasn't any point in wallowing in what might have been. That was only another way to torture yourself. What had actually happened was bad enough.
"We know who did it,"
Dawson said, and a shiver ran through the room. There were more wares in the house. I could sense them now, and all of them had become alert to Trey Dawson's words.
"What? How?"
Without my seeing the movement, Alcide was on his feet.
"She got her witch friends to do a reconstruction,"
Trey said, nodding in my direction.
"I watched. It was two guys. One I'd never seen, so Fernan's brought in some wolves from outside. The second was Cal Myers."
Alcide's big hands were clenched in fists. He didn't seem to know where to start speaking. He had so many reactions.
"Fernan's hired help,"
Alcide said, finally picking a jumping-in point.
"So we're within our rights to kill on sight. We'll snatch one of the bastards and make him talk. We can't bring a hostage here. Someone would notice. Trey, where?"
"Hair the dog,"
he answered. Amanda wasn't too crazy about that idea. She owned that bar, and using it as an execution or torture site didn't appeal to her. She opened her mouth to protest. Alcide faced her and snarled, his face twisting into something that wasn't quite Alcide. She cowered and nodded her assent. Alcide raised his voice even more for his next pronouncement.
"Cal Myers is a kill on sight."
"But he's a pack member, and members get trials," Amanda said, and then cowered, correctly anticipating Alcide's wordless roar of rage.
"You haven't asked me about the man who tried to kill me," I said.
I wanted to defuse the situation, if that was possible. As furious as he was, Alcide was still too decent to remind me that I'd lived and Maria Starr hadn't, or that he'd loved Maria Starr much more than he'd ever cared about me. Both thoughts crossed his mind, though.
"He was where?" I said. "About 5'10", in his 20s. He was clean-shaven. He had brown hair and blue eyes and a big birthmark on his neck."
"Oh," said Amanda. "That sounds like what's-his-name, the brand-new mechanic at Fernan's shop, hired last week. Lucky Owens."
"Ha! Who were you with?"
"I was with Eric Northman," I said. There was a long, not entirely friendly, silence. Wares and vampires are natural rivals, if not out-and-out enemies.
"So the guys did?"
Trey asked practically, and I nodded.
"How'd he approach you?"
Alcide asked in a voice that was more rational.
"That's an interesting question," I said. "I was on the interstate driving home from Shreveport with Eric. We'd been to a restaurant here." So who would know where you were and who you were with? Amanda said, while Alcide frowned down at the floor, deep in thought.
Or that you'd have to return home along the interstate last night.
Trey was really rising, in my opinion. He was right in there with the practical and pertinent ideas. I only told my roommate I was going out to dinner, not where, I said. We met someone there, but we can leave him out. Eric knew, because he was acting as chauffeur, but I know Eric, and the other man didn't tip anyone off.
How can you be so sure?
Trey asked. Eric got shot protecting me, I said, and the person he took me to meet was a relative. Amanda and Trey didn't realize how small my family was, so they didn't get how momentous that statement was. But Alcide, who knew more about me, glared.
You're making this up,
he said. No, I'm not. I stared back. I knew this was a terrible day for Alcide, but I didn't have to explain my life to him. But I had a sudden thought. You know, the waiter, he was aware. That would explain a lot.
What's the name of the restaurant?
Les Deux Poissons. My accent wasn't good, but the wares nodded.
Kendall works there,
Alcide said.
Kendall Kent. Long reddish hair?
I nodded, and he looked sad.
I thought Kendall would come around to our side. We had a beer together a couple of times.
That's Jack Kent's oldest. All he would have had to do was place a phone call, Amanda said. Maybe he didn't know.
Not an excuse,
Trey said. His deep voice reverberated in the little kitchen.
Kendall has to know who Sookie is from the Packmaster contest. She's a friend of the pack. Instead of telling Alcide she was in our territory and should be protected, he called Fernan and told him where Sookie was, maybe let him know when she started home, made it easy for Lucky to lie in wait.
I wanted to protest that there was no certainty that it had happened like that, but when I thought about it, it had to have been exactly that way, or in some manner very close to it. Just to be sure I was remembering correctly, I called Amelia and asked her if she told any callers where I was the night before.
No, she said. I heard from Octavia, who didn't know you. I got a call from that Werepanther boy I met at your brother's wedding. Believe me, you didn't come up in that conversation. Alcide called, real upset. Tanya, I told her nothing.
Thanks, Rumi, I said. You recovering?
Yeah, I'm feeling better. And Octavia left to go back to the family she's been staying with in Monroe.
Okay, see you when I get back.
You going to make it back in time for work?
Yeah, I have to make it to work.
Since I'd spent that week in Rhodes, I have to be careful to stick to the schedule for a while. Otherwise, the other waitresses would get up in my face about Sam giving me all the breaks. I hung up.
She told no one, I said.
So you and Eric had a leisurely dinner at an expensive restaurant with another man?
I looked at him incredulously. This was so far off the point. I concentrated. I'd never poked a mental probe into such turmoil. Alcide was feeling grief for Maria Starr, guilt because he hadn't protected her, anger that I'd been drawn into the conflict, and above all, eagerness to knock some skulls. As the cherry on top of all that, Alcide, irrationally, hated that I'd been out with Eric. I tried to keep my mouth shut out of respect for his loss. I was no stranger to mixed emotions myself, but I found I'd become abruptly and completely tired of him.
Okay, I said. Fight your own battles. I came when you asked me to. I helped you when you asked me to, both at the battle for pack leader and today, at expense and emotional grief to myself. Screw you, Alcide. Maybe Fernan is the better ware.
I spun on my heel and caught the look Trey Dawson was giving Alcide while I marched out of the kitchen, down the steps, and into the carport. If there'd been a can, I would have kicked it.
I'll take you home,
Trey said, appearing at my side, and I marched over to the side of the truck, grateful that he was giving me the wherewithal to leave. When I'd stormed out, I hadn't been thinking about what would happen next. It's the ruin of a good exit when you have to go back and look in the phone book for a cab company.
I'd believed Alcide truly loathed me after the Debbie debacle. Apparently, the loathing was not total.
Kind of ironic, isn't it? I said after a silent spell. I almost got shot last night because Patrick Fernan thought that would upset Alcide. Until 10 minutes ago, I would have sworn that wasn't true.
Trey looked like he would rather be cutting up onions than dealing with this conversation. After another pause, he said,
Alcide's acting like a butthead, but he's got a lot on his plate.
I understand that, I said, and shut my mouth before I said one more word. As it turned out, I was on time to go to work that night. I was so upset while I was changing clothes that I almost split my black pants. I yanked them on so hard. I brushed my hair with such unnecessary vigor that it crackled.
Men are incomprehensible assholes, I said to Amelia.
No shit, she said. When I was searching for Bob today, I found a female cat in the woods with kittens. And guess what? They were all black and white. I really had no idea what to say.
So, to hell with the promise I made him, right? I'm going to have fun. He can go have sex, I can go have sex. And if he vomits on my bedspread again, I'll get after him with the broom.
I was trying not to look directly at Amelia.
I don't blame you, I said, trying to keep my voice steady.
It was nice to be on the verge of laughter instead of wanting to smack someone. I grabbed up my purse, checked my ponytail in the mirror in the hall bathroom, and exited out the back door to drive to Merlot's. I felt tired before I even walked through the employee's door. Not a good way to start my shift. I didn't see Sam when I stowed my purse in the deep desk drawer we all used. When I came out of the hall that accessed the two public bathrooms, Sam's office, the storeroom, and the kitchen, though the kitchen door was kept locked from the inside most of the time, I found Sam behind the bar. I gave him a wave as I tied on the white apron I'd pulled from the stack of dozens. I slid my order pad and a pencil into a pocket, looked around to find Arlene, whom I'd be replacing, and scan the tables in our section. My heart sank. No peaceful evening for me. Some asses in Fellowship of the Sun t-shirts were sitting at one of the tables. The Fellowship was a radical organization that believed, A, vampires were sinful by nature, almost demons, and, B, they should be executed. The Fellowship preachers wouldn't say so publicly, but the Fellowship advocated the total eradication of the undead. I'd heard there was even a little primer to advise members of how that could be carried out. After the Rhodes bombing, they'd become bolder in their hatred. The FOTS group was growing as Americans struggled to come to terms with something they couldn't understand. And as hundreds of vampires streamed into the country that had given them the most favorable reception of all the nations on Earth. Since a few heavily Catholic and Muslim countries had adopted a policy of killing vampires on sight, the U.S. had begun accepting vampires as refugees from religious or political persecution, and the backlash against this policy was violent. I'd recently seen a bumper sticker that read, "I'll say vamps are alive when you pry my cold, dead fingers from my ripped-out throat." I regarded the Fellowship as intolerant and ignorant, and I despise those who belong to its ranks. But I was used to keeping my mouth shut on the topic at the bar, the same way I was used to avoiding discussions on abortion or gun control or gays in the military. Of course, the FOTS guys were probably Arlene's buddies. My weak-minded ex-friend had fallen hook, line, and sinker for the pseudo-religion that the FOTS propagated. Arlene curtly briefed me on the tables as she headed out the back door, her face set hard against me. As I watched her go, I wondered how her kids were. I used to babysit them a lot. They probably hated me now, if they listened to their mother. I shook off my melancholy because Sam didn't pay me to be moody. I made the rounds of the customers, refreshed drinks, made sure everyone had enough food, brought a clean fork for a woman who dropped hers,
supplied extra napkins to the table where Catfish Hennessy was eating chicken strips, and exchanged cheerful words with the guys seated at the bar.
I treated the FOTS table just like I treated everyone else, and they didn't seem to be paying me any special attention, which was just fine with me. I had every expectation that they'd leave with no trouble, until Pam walked in. Pam is white as a sheet of paper and looks just like Alice in Wonderland would look if she'd grown up to become a vampire. In fact, this evening, Pam even had a blue band restraining her straight, fair hair, and she was wearing a dress instead of her usual pants set. She was lovely, even if she looked like a vampire cast in an episode of Leave It to Beaver. Her dress had little puff sleeves with white trim, and her collar had white trim, too. The tiny buttons down the front of her bodice were white to match the polka dots on the skirt. No hose, I noticed, but any hose she bought would look bizarre since the rest of her skin was so pale. "Hey, Pam," I said as she made a beeline for me.
"Sookie,"
she said warmly and gave me a kiss as light as a snowflake. Her lips felt cool on my cheek. "What's up?" I asked. Pam usually worked at Fantasia in the evening.
"I have a date," she said. "Do you think I look good?"
She spun around. "Oh, sure," I said. "You always look good, Pam." That was only the truth. Though Pam's clothing choices were often ultra-conservative and strangely dated, that didn't mean they didn't become her. She had a kind of sweet but lethal charm. "Who's a lucky guy?" She looked as arch as a vampire over 200 years old can look.
"Who says it's a guy?" she said.
"Oh, right." I glanced around. "Who's the lucky person?" Just then, my roomie walked in. Amelia was wearing a beautiful pair of black linen pants and heels with an off-white sweater and a pair of amber and tortoiseshell earrings. She looked conservative, too, but in a more modern way. Amelia strode over to us, smiled at Pam, and said, "Had a drink yet?" Pam smiled in a way I'd never seen her smile before. It was coy.
"No, waiting for you."
They sat at the bar, and Sam served them. Soon they were chatting away, and when their drinks were gone, they got up to leave. When they passed me on their way out, Amelia said, "I'll see you when I see you," her way of telling me she might not be home tonight.
"Okay, you two have fun," I said.
Their departure was followed by more than one pair of male eyes. If corneas steamed up like glasses do, all the guys in the bar would be seeing blurry. I made the round of my tables again, fetching new beers for one, leaving the bill at another, until I reached the table with the two guys wearing the FOTS shirts. They were still watching the door, as though they expected Pam to jump back inside and scream, "Boo!"
"Did I just see what I thought I just saw?"
one of the men asked me. He was in his 30s, clean-shaven, brown-haired, just another guy. The other man was someone I would have eyed with caution if we'd been in an elevator alone. He was thin, had a beard fringe along his jaw, was decorated with a few tattoos that looked like home jobs to me, jail tats, and he was carrying a knife strapped to his ankle, a thing that hadn't been too hard for me to spot once I'd heard in his mind that he was armed.
"What do you think you just saw?"
I asked sweetly. Brown hair thought I was a bit simple, but that was a good camouflage, and it meant that Arlene hadn't sunk to telling all and sundry about my little peculiarities. No one in bon ton, if you asked them outside of church on Sunday, would have said telepathy was possible. If you'd asked them outside of Merlot's on a Saturday night, they might have said there was something to it.
"I think I saw a vamp come in here just like she had a right, and I think I saw a woman acting happy to walk out with her. I swear to God, I cannot believe it."
He looked at me as if I was sure to share his outrage. Jail Tat nodded vigorously.
"I'm sorry. You see two women walking out of a bar together, and that bothers you? I don't understand your problem with that."
Of course I did, but you have to play it out sometimes.
"Sookie?"
Sam was calling me.
"Can I get you gentlemen anything else?"
I asked, since Sam was undoubtedly trying to call me back to my senses. They were both looking at me oddly now, having correctly deduced that I was not exactly down with their program.
I guess we're ready to leave, said Jail Tat, clearly hoping I'd be made to suffer for driving paying customers away. You get our check ready?
I'd had their check ready, and I laid it down on the table in between them. They each glanced at it, slapped a 10 on top, and shoved their chairs back.
I'll be back with your change in just a second, I said, and turned.
No change, said Brown Hair, though his tone was surly, and he didn't seem genuinely thrilled with my service. Jerks, I muttered as I went to the cash register at the bar.
Sam said,
Sookie, you have to suck it up.
I was so surprised that I stared at Sam. We were both behind the bar, and Sam was mixing a vodka Collins. Sam continued quietly, keeping his eyes on his hands.
You have to serve them like they were anybody else.
It wasn't too often that Sam treated me like an employee rather than a trusted associate. It hurt, the more so when I realized he was right. Though I'd been polite on the surface, I would have, and should have, swallowed their last remarks with no comment, if it hadn't been for the FOTS t-shirts. Merlot's wasn't my business, it was Sam's. If customers didn't come back, he'd suffer the consequences. Eventually, if he had to let barmaids go, I would too.
I'm sorry, I said, though it wasn't easy to manage saying it.
I smiled brightly at Sam and went off to do an unnecessary round of my tables, one that probably crossed the line from attentive and into irritating. But if I went into the employee's bathroom or the public ladies' room, I'd end up crying, because it hurt to be admonished, and it hurt to be wrong. But most of all, it hurt to be put in my place. When we closed that night, I left as quickly and quietly as possible. I knew I was going to have to get over being hurt, but I preferred to do my healing in my own home. I didn't want to have any little talks with Sam, or anyone else for that matter. Holly was looking at me with way too much curiosity. So I scooted out to the parking lot with my purse, my apron still on. Trey was leaning against my car. I jumped before I could stop myself.
You running scared?
He asked. No, I'm running upset, I said. What are you doing here?
I'm gonna follow you home,
he said.
Amelia there?
No, she's out on a date.
Then I'm definitely checking out the house,
the big man said, and climbed into his truck to follow me out to Hummingbird Road. There wasn't any reason to object that I could see. In fact, it made me feel good to have someone with me, someone I pretty much trusted. My house was just as I'd left it, or rather as Amelia had left it. The outside security lights had come on automatically, and she'd left the light over the sink on in the kitchen as well as the back porch light. Keys in hand, I crossed to the kitchen door. Trey's big hand gripped my arm when I started to twist the doorknob.
There's no one there, I said, having checked in my own way. And it's warded by Amelia.
You stay here while I look around,
he said gently. I nodded and let him in. After a few seconds' silence, he opened the door to tell me I could come into the kitchen. I was ready to follow him through the house for the rest of his search, but he said,
I'd sure like a glass of Coke if you got any.
He'd deflected me perfectly from following him by appealing to my hospitality. My grandmother would have hit me with a fly swatter if I hadn't gotten Trey a Coke right then. By the time he arrived back in the kitchen and pronounced the house clear of intruders, the icy Coke was sitting in a glass on the table, and there was a meatloaf sandwich sitting by it, with a folded napkin. Without a word, Trey sat down and put the napkin in his lap and ate the sandwich and drank the Coke. I sat opposite him with my own drink.
I hear your man has vanished,
Trey said when he'd patted his lips with the napkin. I nodded.
What do you think happened to him?
I explained the circumstances. So, I haven't heard a word from him, I concluded. This story was sounding almost automatic, like I ought to tape it.
That's bad,
was all he said. Somehow it made me feel better, this quiet, undramatic discussion of a very touchy subject. After a minute of thoughtful silence, Trey said,
I hope you find him soon.
Thanks. I'm real anxious to know how he's doing. That was a huge understatement.
Well, I'd better be getting on, he said. If you get nervous in the night, you call me. I can be here in 10 minutes. It's no good you being alone out here with the war starting.
I had a mental image of tanks coming down my driveway. How bad do you think it could get? I asked.
My dad told me in the last war, which was when his daddy was little, the pack in Shreveport got into it with the pack in Monroe. The Shreveport pack was about 40 then, counting the halfies.
Halfies was the common term for wares who'd become wolves by being bitten. They could only turn into a kind of wolf man, never achieving the perfect wolf form that born wares thought was vastly superior.
But the Monroe pack had a bunch of college kids in it, so it came up to 40, 45, too. At the end of the fighting, both packs were halved.
I thought of the wares I knew. I hope it stops now, I said.
It ain't gonna,
Trey said practically.
They've tasted blood, and killing Alcide's girl instead of trying for Alcide was a cowardly way to open the fight. Them trying to get you, too, that only made it worse. You don't have a drop of wear blood. You're a friend of the pack. That should make you untouchable, not a target. And this afternoon, Alcide found Christine Larrabee dead.
I was shocked all over again. Christine Larrabee was, had been, the widow of one of the previous pack leaders. She had a high standing in the Ware community, and she'd rather reluctantly endorsed Jackson Hervaux for pack leader. Now she had gotten a delayed payback. He's not going after any man? I finally managed to speak. Trey's face was dark with contempt.
No,
the Ware said.
The only way I can read it is, Fernan wants to set Alcide's temper off. He wants everyone to be on a hair trigger, while Fernan himself stays cool and collected. He's about got what he wants, too. Between grief and the personal insult, Alcide is aimed to go off like a shotgun. He needs to be more like a sniper rifle.
Isn't Fernan's strategy real unusual?
Yes,
Trey said heavily.
I don't know what's gotten into him. Apparently, he don't want to face Alcide in personal combat. He don't want to just beat Alcide. He's aiming to kill Alcide and all Alcide's people, as far as I can tell. A few of the Wares, the ones with little kids, they already repledged themselves to him. They're too scared of what he'd do to their kids after the attacks against women.
The Ware stood.
Thanks for the food. I've got to go feed my dogs. You lock up good after me, you hear? And where's your cell phone?
I handed it to him, and with surprisingly neat movements for such large hands, Trey programmed his cell phone number into my directory. Then he left with a casual wave of his hand. He had a small, neat house by his repair shop, and I was really relieved to find he'd timed the journey from there to here at only 10 minutes. I locked the door behind him, and I checked the kitchen windows. Sure enough, Amelia had left one open at some point during the mild afternoon. After that discovery, I felt compelled to check every window in the house, even the ones upstairs. After that was done, and I felt as secure as I was going to feel, I turned on the television and sat in front of it, not really seeing what was happening on the screen. I had a lot to think about. Months ago, I'd gone to the Packmaster contest at Alcide's request to watch for trickery. It was my bad luck that my presence had been noticed and my discovery of Fernan's treachery had been public. It griped me that I'd been drawn into this fight, which was none of my own. In fact, bottom line, knowing Alcide had brought me nothing but grief. I was almost relieved to feel a head of anger building at this injustice, but my better self urged me to squash it in the bud. It wasn't Alcide's fault that Debbie Pelt had been such a murderous bitch, and it wasn't Alcide's fault that Patrick Fernan had decided to cheat in the contest. Likewise, Alcide wasn't responsible for Fernan's bloodthirsty and uncharacteristic approach to consolidating his pack. I wondered if this behavior was even remotely wolf-like.
I figured it was just Patrick Fernan-like.
The telephone rang, and I jumped about a mile.
Hello?
I said, unhappy at how frightened I sounded.
Beware, Hervaux called me,
Eric said.
He confirms that he's at war with his packmaster.
Yeah, I said. You needed confirmation from Alcide? My message wasn't enough?
I had thought of an alternative to the theory that you were attacked in a strike against Alcide. I'm sure Niall must have mentioned that he has enemies.
Uh-huh.
I wondered if one of those enemies had acted very swiftly. If the Wares have spies, so may the fairies.
I pondered that. So, in wanting to meet me, he almost caused my death.
But he had the wisdom to ask me to escort you to and from Shreveport.
So he saved my life, even though he risked it. Silence. Actually, I said, leaping to firmer emotional ground, you saved my life, and I'm grateful. I half expected Eric to ask me just how grateful I was, to refer to the kissing, but still he didn't speak. Just as I was about to blurt out something stupid to break the silence, the vampire said,
I'll only interfere in the Ware War to defend our interests, or to defend you.
My turn for a silent spell. All right, I said weakly.
If you see trouble coming, if they try to draw you in further, call me immediately,
Eric told me.
I believe the assassin truly was sent by the packmaster. Certainly he was a Ware.
Some of Alcide's people recognized the description. The guy, lucky somebody, had just been taken on by Fernan as a mechanic.
Strange that he'd entrust such an errand to someone he hardly knew.
Since the guy turned out to be so unlucky, Eric actually snorted. Then he said,
I won't talk to Niall of this any further. Of course, I told him what occurred.
I had a moment's ridiculous pang because Niall hadn't rushed to my side or called to ask if I was okay. I'd only met him once, and now I was sad he wasn't acting like my nursemaid. All right, Eric, thanks, I said, and hung up as he was saying goodbye. I should have asked him about my money again, but I was too dispirited. Besides, it wasn't Eric's problem. I was jumpy the whole time I was getting ready for bed, but nothing happened to make me more anxious. I reminded myself about 50 times that Amelia had warded the house. The wards would work whether she was in the house or not. I had some good locks on the doors. I was tired. Finally, I slept, but I woke up more than once, listening for an assassin. Chapter 8. I got up with heavy eyes the next day. I felt groggy and my head hurt. I had what amounted to an emotional hangover. Something had to change. I couldn't spend another night like this. I wondered if I should call Alcide and see if he'd, gone to the mattresses with his soldiers. Maybe they'd let me have a corner. But the very idea of having to do that to feel safe made me angry. I couldn't stop the thought from going through my head. If Quinn were here, I could stay in my own home without fear. And for a moment, I wasn't just worried about my missing wounded boyfriend. I was mad at him. I was ready to be mad at someone. There was too much loose emotion hanging around. Well, this was the beginning of a very special day, huh? No, Amelia. I had to assume she'd spent the night with Pam. I didn't have any problem with their having a relationship. I simply wanted Amelia to be around because I was lonely and scared. Her absence left a little blank spot in my landscape. At least the air was cooler this morning. You could feel clearly that fall was on the way, was already in the ground, waiting to leap up and claim the leaves and grass and flowers.
I put on a sweater over my nightgown and went out on the front porch to drink my first cup of coffee. I listened to the birds for a while. They weren't as noisy as they were in the spring, but their songs and discussions let me know that nothing unusual was in the woods this morning. I finished my coffee and tried to plan out my day, but I kept running up against a mental roadblock. It was hard to make plans when you suspected someone might try to kill you. If I could tear myself away from the issue of my possibly impending death, I needed to vacuum the downstairs, do a load of my laundry, and go to the library. If I survived those chores, I had to go to work. I wondered where Quinn was. I wondered when I'd hear from my new great-grandfather again. I wondered if any more wares had died during the night. I wondered when my phone would ring. Since nothing happened on my front porch, I dragged myself inside and did my usual morning get-ready routine. When I looked at the mirror, I was sorry I'd troubled. I didn't look rested and refreshed. I looked like a worried person who hadn't gotten any sleep. I dabbed some concealer beneath my eyes and put on a little extra eyeshadow and blush to give my face some color. Then I decided I looked like a clown and rubbed most of it off. After feeding Bob and scolding him for the litter of kittens, I checked all my locks again and hopped in the car to go to the library. The Renard Parish Library, Bonton Branch, is not a large building. Our librarian graduated from Louisiana Tech in Ruston, and she's a super lady in her late 30s named Barbara Beck. Her husband, Al C., is a detective on the Bonton Force, and I really hope Barbara doesn't know what he's up to. Al C. Beck is a tough man who does good things, sometimes. He also does quite a few bad things. Al C. was lucky when he got Barbara to marry him, and he knows it. Barbara's the only full-time employee of the branch library, and I wasn't surprised to find her by herself when I pushed open the heavy door. She was shelving books. Barbara dressed in what I thought of as comfortable chic, meaning she picked out knits in bright colors and wore matching shoes. She favored chunky, bold jewelry, too. "Good morning, Sookie," she said, smiling her big smile. "Barbara," I said, trying to smile back. She noticed I wasn't my usual self, but she kept her thoughts to herself. Not really, of course, since I have my little disability, but she didn't say anything out loud. I put the books I was returning on the appropriate desk, and I began looking at the shelves of new arrivals. Most of them were some permutation on self-help. Going by how popular these books were and how often they were checked out, everyone in Bonton should have become perfect by now. I grabbed up two new romances and a couple of mysteries and even a science fiction, which I rarely read. I guess I thought my reality was crazier than anything a science fiction writer could dream up. While I was looking at the jacket of a book by an author I'd never read, I heard a thunk in the background and knew someone had come in the back door of the library. I didn't pay attention. Some people habitually use the back door. Barbara made a little noise, and I looked up. The man behind her was huge, at least 6'6", and whip-thin. He had a big knife, and he was holding it to Barbara's throat. For a second, I thought he was a robber, and I wondered who would ever think of robbing a library for the overdue book money. "Don't scream," he hissed through long, sharp teeth. I froze. Barbara was in some space beyond fear. She was way into terror, but I could hear another active brain in the building. Someone else was coming in the back door very quietly. "Detective Beck will kill you for hurting his wife," I said very loudly, and I said it with absolute certainty. "Kiss your ass goodbye."
"I don't know who that is, and I don't care," the tall man said.
"You better care, motherfucker,"
said Al C. Beck, who stepped up behind him silently. He put his gun to the man's head.
"Now, you let go of my wife and you drop that knife."
But Sharpteeth wasn't about to do that. He spun, pushed Barbara at Al C., and ran right toward me, knife raised. I threw a Nora Roberts hardback at him, whacking him upside his head. I extended my foot. Blinded by the impact of the book, Sharpteeth tripped over the foot, just as I'd hoped. He fell on his own knife, which I hadn't planned. The library fell abruptly silent except for Barbara's gasping breath.
Alcee Beck and I stared down at the creeping pool of blood coming out from under the man. "Uh-oh," I said.
"Well, shit,"
said Alcee Beck.
"Where'd you learn to throw like that, Sookie Stackhouse?"
"Softball," I said, which was the literal truth. As you can imagine, I was late to work that afternoon. I was even more tired than I had been to start with, but I was thinking that I might live through the day. So far, two times in a row, fate had intervened to prevent my assassination. I had to assume that Sharpteeth had been sent to kill me and had botched it, just as the fake highway patrolman had done. Maybe my luck wouldn't hold a third time, but there was a chance it would. What were the odds that another vampire would take a bullet for me, or that, by sheer accident, Alcee Beck would drop off his wife's lunch that she'd left at home on the kitchen counter? Slim, right? But I'd beaten those odds twice. No matter what the police were officially assuming, since I didn't know the guy and no one could say I did, and he'd seized Barbara, not me, Alcee Beck now had me in his sights. He was really good at reading situations, and he had seen that Sharpteeth was focused on me. Barbara had been a means to get my attention. Alcee would never forgive me for that, even if it hadn't been my fault. Plus, I'd thrown that book with suspicious force and accuracy. In his place, I would probably feel the same way. So now I was at Merlot's, going through the motions in a weary way, wondering where to go and what to do, and why Patrick Fernan had gone nuts. And where had all these strangers come from? I hadn't known the Ware who'd broken down Maria Starr's door. Eric had been shot by a guy who worked at Patrick Fernan's dealership only a few days. I'd never seen Sharpteeth before, and he was an unforgettable kind of guy. The whole situation made no sense at all. Suddenly, I had an idea. I asked Sam if I could make a phone call, since my tables were quiet, and he nodded. He'd been giving me those narrow looks all evening, looks that meant he was going to pin me down and talk to me soon. But for now, I had a breather. So I went into Sam's office, looked in his Shreveport phone book to get the listing for Patrick Fernan's home, and I called him.
"Hello?"
I recognized the voice. "Patrick Fernan?" I said, just to be sure.
"Speaking."
"Why are you trying to kill me?"
"What? Who is this?"
"Oh, come on. It's Sookie Stackhouse. Why are you doing this?" There was a long pause.
"Are you trying to trap me?" he asked.
"How? You think I got the phone tapped? I want to know why. I never did anything to you. I'm not even dating Alcee, but you're trying to off me like I am powerful. You killed poor Maria Starr. You killed Christine Larrabee. What's with this? I'm not important." Patrick Fernan said slowly,
"You really believe it's me doing this? Killing female pack members? Trying to kill you?"
"Sure I do."
"It's not me. I read about Maria Starr. Christine Larrabee is dead?"
He sounded almost frightened. "Yes," I said, and my voice was as uncertain as his. "And someone's tried to kill me twice. I'm afraid some totally innocent person is going to get caught in the crossfire, and of course I don't want to die." Fernan said,
"My wife disappeared yesterday."
His voice was ragged with grief and fear and anger.
"Alcide's got her, and that fucker's going to pay."
"Alcee wouldn't do that," I said. Well, I was pretty sure Alcee wouldn't do that. "You're saying you didn't order the hits on Maria Starr and Christine? And me?"
"No, why would I go for the women? We never want to kill pure-blooded female wares, except maybe Amanda,"
Fernan added tactlessly.
"If we're going to kill someone, it'd be the men."
"I think you and Alcee need to have a sit-down. He doesn't have your wife. He thinks you've gone crazy attacking women." There was a long silence. Fernan said,
"I think you're right about that sit-down, unless you made up this whole thing to get me into a position where Alcee can kill me."
I just want to live to see the next week myself.
I'll agree to meet with Alcide. If you'll be there, and if you'll swear to tell each of us what the other is thinking, you're a friend of the pack, all the pack. You can help us now.
Patrick Fernan was so anxious to find his wife, he was even willing to believe in me. I thought of the deaths that had already taken place. I thought of the deaths that were to come, perhaps including my own. I wondered what the hell was going on.
I'll do it if you and Alcide will sit down unarmed, I said. If what I suspect is true, you have a common enemy who's trying to get you two to kill each other off.
If that black-haired bastard will agree to it, I'll give it a shot, said Fernan. If Alcide has my wife, not a hair on her body better be disturbed, and he better bring her with him, or I swear to God I'll dismember him.
I understand. I'll make sure he understands, too. We'll be getting back with you, I promised, and I hoped with all my heart that I was telling the truth. Chapter 9. It was the middle of the same night, and I was about to walk into danger. It was my own damn fault. Through a swift series of phone calls, Alcide and Fernan had worked out where to meet. I'd envisioned them sitting down across a table, their lieutenants right behind them, and working this whole situation out. Mrs. Fernan would appear, and the couple would reunite. Everyone would be content, or at least less hostile. I would be nowhere around. Yet here I was at an abandoned office center in Shreveport, the same one where the contest for Packmaster had taken place. At least Sam was with me. It was dark and cool, and the wind was lifting my hair from my shoulders. I shifted from foot to foot, anxious to get this over with. Though he was not as fidgety as I was, I could tell Sam felt the same way. It was my fault he was here. When he'd become so curious about what was brewing with the Wares, I'd had to tell him. After all, if someone came through the door of Merlot's trying to shoot me down, Sam at least deserved to know why his bar was full of holes. I'd argued bitterly with him when he told me he was coming with me, but here we both were. Maybe I'm lying to myself. Maybe I simply wanted a friend with me, someone definitely on my side. Maybe I was just scared. Actually, no maybe about that at all. The night was brisk, and we were both wearing waterproof jackets with hoods. Not that we needed hoods, but if it got any colder, we might be grateful for them. The abandoned office park stretched around us in gloomy silence. We stood in the loading bay of a firm that accepted big shipments of something. The large metal pull-down doors where the trucks had been unloaded looked like big shiny eyes in the gleam of the remaining security lights. Actually, there were lots of big shiny eyes around tonight. The Sharks and the Jets were negotiating. Oh, excuse me, the Fernan Wares and the Hervaux Wares. The two sides of the pack might come to an understanding, and they might not. And right smack dab in the middle stood Sam the shapeshifter and Sookie the telepath. As I felt the hard red throbbing of Ware brains approaching from both north and south, I turned to Sam and said from the bottom of my heart, I should never have let you come with me. I should never have opened my mouth.
You've gotten into the habit of not telling me things, Sookie. I want you to tell me what's going on with you, especially if there's danger.
Sam's red-gold hair blew around his head in the sharp little breeze wafting between the buildings. I felt his difference more strongly than I ever had. Sam is a rare, true shapeshifter. He can change into anything. He prefers the form of a dog because dogs are familiar and friendly and people don't shoot at them too often. I looked into his blue eyes and saw the wildness in them.
They're here, he said, raising his nose to the breeze.
Then the two groups were standing about 10 feet away on either side of us, and it was time to concentrate. I recognized the faces of a few of the Fernan wolves, who were more numerous. Cal Myers, the police detective, was among them. It took some kind of nerve for Fernan to bring Cal along when he was proclaiming his innocence. I also recognized the teenage girl Fernan had taken as part of his victory celebration after Jackson Hervaux's defeat. She looked a million years older tonight. Alcide's group included auburn-haired Amanda, who nodded at me, her face serious, and some werewolves I'd seen at the Hair of the Dog the night Quinn and I had visited the bar. The scrawny girl who'd worn the red leather bustier that night was standing right behind Alcide, and she was both intensely excited and deeply scared. To my surprise, Dawson was there. He wasn't as much of a lone wolf as he'd painted himself to be. Alcide and Fernan stepped away from their packs. This was the agreed-on format for the parley, or sit-down, or whatever you wanted to call it. I would stand between Fernan and Alcide. Each were-leader would grip one of my hands. I would be the human lie detector while they talked. I'd sworn to tell each one if the other lied, at least to the best of my ability. I could read minds, but minds can be deceptive and tricky, or just dance. I'd never done anything exactly like this, and I prayed my ability would be extra precise tonight and that I would use it wisely so I could help to end this life-taking. Alcide approached me stiffly, his face harsh in the hard glare of the security lighting. For the first time, I noticed that he looked thinner and older. There was a little gray in the black hair that hadn't been there when his father had been alive. Patrick Fernan, too, didn't look well. He'd always had a tendency to porkiness, and now he looked as though he'd gained a good 15 or 20 pounds. Being packmaster hadn't been good to him, and the shock of the abduction of his wife had laid its mark on his face. I did something that I never imagined I would do. I held out my right hand to him. He took it, and the flood of his ideas washed through me instantly. Even his twisty ware brain was easy to read because he was so focused. I held out my left hand to Alcide, and he grasped it too tightly. For a long minute, I felt inundated. Then, with a huge effort, I channeled them into a stream so I wouldn't be overwhelmed. It would be easy for them to lie out loud, but it's not so easy to lie inside your own head, not consistently. I closed my eyes. A flip of the coin had given Alcide the first question.
Patrick, why did you kill my woman?
The words sounded like they were cutting up Alcide's throat.
She was pure ware, and she was as gentle as a ware can be. I never ordered any of my people to kill any of yours,
Patrick Fernan said. He sounded so tired he could hardly stand up, and his thoughts were proceeding in much the same way, slowly, wearily, on a track he'd worn in his own brain. He was easier to read than Alcide. He meant what he said. Alcide was listening with great attention, and he said next,
Did you tell anyone not in your pack to kill Maria Starr and Sookie and Mrs. Larrabee? I never gave orders to kill any of you, ever,
Fernan said. He believes that, I said. Unfortunately, Fernan wouldn't shut up.
I hate you,
he said, sounding just as tired as he had before.
I would be glad if a truck hit you, but I didn't kill anyone.
He believes that, too, I said, maybe a little dryly. Alcide demanded,
How can you claim to be innocent with Cal Myers standing with your pack? He stabbed Maria Starr to death.
Fernan looked confused.
Cal wasn't there, he said.
He believes what he says, I told Alcide. I turned my face to Fernan. Cal was there, and he murdered Maria Starr. Though I dared not lose focus, I heard the whispering start all around Cal Myers, saw the rest of the Fernan wares step away from him. It was Fernan's turn to ask a question.
My wife,
he said, and his voice cracked.
Why her? I didn't take Libby,
Alcide said.
I would never abduct a woman, especially a werewoman with young. I would never order anyone else to do it.
He believed that. Alcide didn't do it himself, and he didn't order it done. But Alcide hated Patrick Fernan with a great ferocity. Fernan hadn't needed to kill Jackson Hervaux at the climax of the contest, but he had. Better to start his leadership with the elimination of his rival.
Jackson would never have submitted to his rule, and he would have been a thorn in his side for years. I was getting thoughts from both sides, wafts of ideas so strong it burned in my head, and I said, "Calm down, both of you." I could feel Sam behind me, his warmth, the touch of his mind, and I said, "Sam, don't touch me, okay?" He understood, and he moved away. "Neither of you killed any of the people who have died, and neither of you ordered it done, as far as I can tell." Alcide said,
"Give us Cal Myers to question." "Then where's my wife?" Fernan growled.
"Dead and gone," said a clear voice, "and I'm ready to take her place. Cal is mine." We all looked up because the voice had come from the flat roof of the building. There were four Wares up there, and the brunette female who'd spoken was closest to the edge. She had a sense of the dramatic, I'll give her that. Female Wares have power and status, but they're not pack leader, ever. This woman was clearly large and in charge, though she was maybe 5'2". She had prepared to change, that is to say, she was naked. Or maybe she just wanted Alcide and Fernan to see what they could be getting, which was a lot, both in quantity and in quality.
"Priscilla," said Fernan.
It seemed like such an unlikely name for the Ware that I felt myself actually smile, which was a bad idea under the circumstances.
"You know her,"
Alcide said to Fernan.
"Is this part of your plan?"
"No," I answered for him. My mind careened through the thoughts I could read and latched onto one thread in particular. "Fernan, Cal is her creature," I said. "He's betrayed you."
"I thought if I picked off a few key bitches, you two would kill each other off," Priscilla said. "Too bad it didn't work."
"Who is this?" Alcide asked Fernan again.
"She's the maid of Arthur A. Bear, a pack leader from St. Catherine Parish."
St. Catherine was way south, just east of New Orleans. It had been hit hard by Katrina.
"Arthur is dead. We don't have a home anymore," Priscilla A. Bear said. "We want yours."
Well, that was clear enough.
"Cal, why have you done this?"
Fernan asked his lieutenant. Cal should have gotten up on the roof while he was able. The Fernan wolves and the Hervaux wolves had formed a circle around him.
"Cal's my brother," Priscilla called. "You better not touch a hair on his body."
There was an edge of desperation to her voice that hadn't been there before. Cal looked up at his sister unhappily. He realized what a fix he was in, and I was pretty sure he wanted her to shut up. That would be his last thought. Fernan's arm was suddenly out of its sleeve and covered with hair. With huge force, he swung at his former cohort, eviscerating the Ware. Alcide's clawed hand took off the back of Cal's head as the traitor fell to the ground. Cal's blood sprayed over me in an arc. At my back, Sam was humming with the energy of his oncoming change, triggered by the tension, the smell of blood, and my involuntary yelp. Priscilla A. Bear roared in rage and anguish. With inhuman grace, she leaped from the top of the building to the parking lot, followed by her henchmen. Hench wolves? The war had begun. Sam and I had worked ourselves into the middle of the Shreveport wolves. As Priscilla's pack began closing in from each side, Sam said,
"I'm going to change, Sookie."
I couldn't see what use a collie would be in this situation, but I said, "Okay, boss." He grinned at me in a lopsided way, stripped off his clothes, and bent over. All around us, the Wares were doing the same. The chill night air was full of the gloppy sound, the sound of hard things moving through thick, sticky liquid that characterizes the transformation from man to animal. Huge wolves straightened and shook themselves all around me. I recognized the wolf forms of Alcide and Fernan. I tried counting the wolves in our suddenly reunited pack, but they were milling around, positioning themselves for the coming battle, and there was no way to keep track of them. I turned to Sam to give him a pat and found myself standing beside a lion. "Sam," I said in a whisper, and he roared. Everyone froze in place for a long moment. The Shreveport wolves were just as scared as the St. Catherine's wolves at first, but then they seemed to realize that Sam was on their side, and yips of excitement echoed between the empty buildings. Then, the fighting started. Sam tried to surround me, which was impossible, but it was a gallant attempt. As an unarmed human, I was basically helpless in this struggle. It was a very unpleasant feeling, in fact, a terrifying feeling. I was the frailest thing on sight. Sam was magnificent. His huge paws flashed, and when he hit a wolf square on, that wolf went down. I danced around like a demented elf, trying to stay out of the way. I couldn't watch everything that was going on. Clusters of St. Catherine wolves made for Fernan, Alcide, and Sam, while individual battles went on around us. I realized that these clusters had been charged with taking down the leaders, and I knew that a lot of planning had gone into this. Priscilla A. Bear hadn't allowed for getting her brother out quickly enough, but that wasn't slowing her down any. No one seemed to be too concerned with me, since I posed no threat, but there was every chance I'd get knocked down by the snarling combatants and be hurt as severely as I would if I had been the target. Priscilla, now a gray wolf, targeted Sam. I guess she wanted to prove she had more balls than anyone by going for the biggest and most dangerous target. But Amanda was biting at Priscilla's hind legs as Priscilla worked her way through the melee. Priscilla responded by turning her head to bare her teeth at the smaller wolf. Amanda danced away, and then, when Priscilla turned to resume her progress, Amanda darted back to bite the leg again. Since Amanda's bite was powerful enough to break bone, this was more than an annoyance, and Priscilla rounded on her in full display. Before I could even think, oh no, Priscilla seized Amanda in her iron jaws and broke her neck. While I stood staring in horror, Priscilla dropped Amanda's body on the ground and wheeled to leap onto Sam's back. He shook and shook, but she had sunk her fangs into his neck, and she would not be dislodged. Something in me snapped as surely as the bones in Amanda's neck. I lost any sense I might have had, and I launched myself in the air, as if I were a wolf too. To keep from sliding off the heaving mass of animals, I wound my arms in the fur around Priscilla's neck, and I wound my legs around Priscilla's middle, and I tightened my arms until I was just about hugging myself. Priscilla didn't want to let go of Sam, so she flung herself from side to side to knock me loose, but I was clinging to her like a homicidal monkey. Finally, she had to let go of his neck to deal with me. I squeezed and squeezed harder, and she tried to bite me, but she couldn't reach around properly since I was on her back. She was able to curve enough to graze my leg with her fangs, but she couldn't hold on. The pain hardly registered. I tightened my grip even more, though my arms were aching like hell. If I let her go one little bit, I would join Amanda. Though all of this took place so quickly, it was hard to believe. I felt as if I'd been trying to kill this woman, wolf, for eternity. I wasn't really thinking, die, die, in my head. I just wanted her to stop what she was doing, and she wouldn't, damn it. Then there was another ear-shattering roar, and huge teeth flashed an inch away from my arms. I understood I should let go, and the second my arms loosened, I tumbled off the wolf, rolling over the pavement to land in a heap a few feet away. There was a sort of pop, and Claudine was standing over me. She was in a tank top and pajama bottoms, and she had a case of bedhead. From between her striped legs, I saw the lion bite the wolf's head nearly off, then spit her out in a fastidious way. Then he turned to survey the parking lot, evaluating the next threat. One of the wolves leaped at Claudine. She proved she was completely awake. While the animal was in midair, her hands clamped on its ears. She swung him, using his own momentum. Claudine flung the huge wolf with the ease of a frat boy tossing a beer can, and the wolf smacked against the loading dock with a sound that seemed quite final. The speed of this attack and its conclusion was absolutely incredible. Claudine didn't move from her straddling stance, and I was smart enough to stay put. Actually, I was exhausted, frightened, and a little bloody, though only the red spatter on my leg seemed to be my own. Fighting takes such a short time, yet it uses up the body's reserves with amazing speed. At least, that's the way it works with humans. Claudine looked pretty sparky.
"Bring it on, fur ass!" she shrieked,
beckoning with both hands to a ware who was slinking up on her from behind. She twisted around without moving her legs, a maneuver that would be impossible for a mundane human body. The ware launched and got exactly the same treatment as its packmate. As far as I could tell, Claudine wasn't even breathing heavy. Her eyes were wider and more intent than usual, and she held her body in a loose crouch, clearly ready for action. There was more roaring and barking and growling and shrieks of pain and rending noises that didn't bear thinking about. But after maybe 5 minutes more of battle, the noise died down. Claudine had not even glanced down at me during this time because she was guarding my body. When she did, she winced, so I looked pretty bad.
"I was late," she said, shifting her feet so she was standing on one side of me. She reached down, and I seized her hand. In a flash, I was on my feet. I hugged her. Not only did I want to, I needed to. Claudine always smelled so wonderful, and her body was curiously firmer to the touch than human flesh. She seemed happy to hug me back, and we clung together for a long moment while I regained my equilibrium. Then I raised my head to look around, dreading what I would see. The fallen lay in heaps of fur around us. The dark stains on the pavement were not from oil drips. Here and there, a bedraggled wolf nosed through the corpses, looking for someone in particular. The lion was crouched a couple of yards away, panting. Blood streaked his fur. There was an open wound on his shoulder, the one caused by Priscilla. There was another bite on his back. I didn't know what to do first.
"Thanks, Claudine," I said, and kissed her cheek.
"I can't always make it," Claudine cautioned me. "Don't count on an automatic rescue."
"Am I wearing some kind of fairy life alert button? How'd you know to come?" I could tell she wasn't going to answer. "Anyway, I sure appreciate this rescue. Hey, I guess you know I met my great-grandfather."
I was babbling. I was so glad to be alive. She bowed her head. "The prince is my grandfather," she said.
"Oh," I said. "So we're like cousins?"
She looked down at me, her eyes clear and dark and calm. She didn't look like a woman who just killed two wolves as quick as you can snap your fingers.
"Yes," she said. "I guess we are." "So, what do you call him? Granddaddy? Popsy?"
"I call him my lord."
"Oh."
She stepped away to check out the wolves she disposed of. I was pretty sure they were still dead. So I went over to the lion. I crouched beside him and put my arm around his neck. He rumbled. Automatically, I scratched the top of his head and behind his ears, just like I did with Bob. The rumble intensified.
"Sam," I said, "thanks so much. I owe you my life. How bad are your wounds? What can I do about them?"
Sam sighed. He laid his head on the ground.
"You're tired?"
Then the air around him got hyper, and I pulled away from him. I knew what was coming. After a few moments, the body that lay beside me was human, not animal. I ran my eyes over Sam anxiously, and I saw that he still had the wounds, but they were much smaller than they'd been on his lion form. All shapeshifters are great at healing. It says a lot about the way my life had changed that it didn't seem significant to me that Sam was buck naked. I had kind of gone beyond that now, which was good since there were bare bodies all around me. The corpses were changing back, as well as the injured wolves. It had been easier to look at the bodies in wolf form. Cal Myers and his sister Priscilla were dead, of course, as were the two wares Claudine had dispatched. Amanda was dead. The skinny girl I'd met in the hair of the dog was alive, though severely wounded in the upper thigh. I recognized Amanda's bartender, too. He seemed unscathed. Trey Dawson was cradling an arm that looked broken. Patrick Fernan lay in the middle of a ring of the dead and wounded, all of them Priscilla's wolves. With some difficulty, I picked my way through broken, bloody bodies. I could feel all the eyes, wolf and human, focus on me as I squatted by him. I put my fingers on his neck and got nothing. I checked his wrist. I even put my hand against his chest. No movement.
"Gone," I said, and those remaining in wolf form began to howl. Far more disturbing were the howls coming from the throats of the wares in human form. Alcide staggered over to me. He appeared to be more or less intact, though streaks of blood matted his chest hair. He passed the slain Priscilla, kicking her corpse as he went by. He knelt for a moment by Patrick Fernan, dipping his head as though he was bowing to the corpse. Then he rose to his feet. He looked dark, savage, and resolute.